Welcome, everyone. My name is Bonnie, and I will be hosting today's Awaken Call. Thank you so much for joining us from wherever you happen to be in the world. The intention behind these calls is to plant seeds of awareness and transformation within ourselves and our communities through conversations with individuals whose journey and work inspire us. Awaken Calls is an initiative of Service Space, a distributed, global, all-volunteer community committed to the principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world. Behind each of these calls is an entire Service Space team whose invisible work allows us to hold the space. In a few minutes, our moderator, Ari, will begin by engaging in an initial dialogue with our speaker, Parag Agarwal. And by the top of the hour, we'll open into a circle of sharing where we will draw upon reflections and questions from our listeners. At any time during the call, you can submit your comments or questions via the webcast form on our live stream page, or you can email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ASK@servicespace.org. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the recording later, we're so grateful for your presence in co-creating and deepening the collective energy of this conversation. And a friendly reminder that if there is a technological glitch or other issue for any of the speakers, please hang in there while our team works quickly to bring the speakers back on. Why don't we start now with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space? Thank you, and welcome again. Our moderator for the conversation today with Parag Agarwal is Ari Nessel. Ari is an entrepreneur and philanthropist based in Marin County, California. He oversees Nessel Development, a forward-thinking real estate redevelopment that focuses on the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit. He is the visionary behind the Pollination Project, a grassroots-focused philanthropic organization designed to tackle societal indifference by fostering a dynamic global community of changemakers who seek to spread compassion in the world. Ari spends most of his time these days leading Food Solutions Action, a nonprofit focused on advancing the alternative protein sector. There, he extensively engages with members of Congress and the Senate, as well as with governors, to raise awareness about the great potential of this industry to address climate change, animal cruelty, food security, and public health. Ari is a great friend, great mentor, and a great person. And now he will introduce our guest. Ari, I pass it over to you.
Thanks, Bonnie. I'm so grateful I get to do this call with you. You've been an inspiration for me in my life, having visited your center, your spiritual center, and spent time with you in India and Northern California. I feel like I'm with family here.
Thank you.
And I second that also for this conversation with Parag Agarwal, who I met, I believe, just after COVID began. I'll give you a little formal background on Parag, and then I can add a little more about my personal experience with him. Parag is a figure whose career and personal mission blend corporate leadership with deep social impact. As the CFO of Dr. Reddy's, Parag's professional success is matched by his passionate advocacy for the vulnerable. First focusing on underprivileged children and later driven by a profound awakening to animal welfare, dedicating himself to the cause of animal rights in India, all while still working as a CFO of a very large multi-billion dollar company. In 2022, Parag co-founded the India Animal Fund, initiative blessed by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, aimed at combating animal exploitation and ensuring animals live with dignity. This organization, alongside his roles in founding the Ahimsa Trust, the plant-based food Association and the Physicians Association for Nutrition underscores Parag's commitment to systemic change, promoting compassion, plant-based living, and nutritional awareness. Wow, that's like four organizations I just named that you've started, Parag, in just a few years. Parag's journey to mindfulness and personal growth through Vipassana meditation and the teachings of the Buddha have been transformative, guiding him towards inner peace and further inspiring his philanthropic vision. His dedication extends beyond his initiatives. He and his family have pledged to donate 50% of their net worth to societal causes, embodying their commitment to making a tangible difference. Join me as we explore the multifaceted life of Parag Agrawal, a leader whose work is a testament to the power of compassion and transformation, addressing some of today's most pressing challenges. Before I pass it on to you, Parag, with a question, I'll just augment what I just read to say that there is a uniqueness that I think a lot of people have who are compassionate, that they want to do something, anything, and just help the pain in front of them, which is so important. And you have the uniqueness of applying that compassion to systemic problems, to the underlying cause. And then there's a part of people who are more from the corporate world who come to it from a very head-centered approach. And you bring heart. So somehow you are as a person, are a person who bridges all these things and combine it with this remarkable ability to manifest change, to set intentions, and then to make those intentions happen very quickly in a very large country. So with that, I'll just say I am blessed to know you. I'm blessed to have this call with you, and the world is blessed to have you in it. And I'm going to start off with just an invitation for you to get us started. And that's just, we'd love to hear a little bit about your journey to where you are today. It didn't start off in this way. And maybe you can share a little about the key points of your life, the underpinnings that led you on this most recent part of your path, this second inning, as you've called it in other interviews.
Yes.
And so please begin.
Yeah, thank you, Ari. First of all, I must say that you are an inspiration for me. I mean, you are one of the first people I connected with when I started to get into animal welfare and to understand how complex this whole issue is. It's a blessing to be talking to you and to know Bonnie. You have been very kind in the introduction, I must say. Talking about myself, I must say that I come from a very small town in India, Ari, a very humble background. And as I grew up and started doing well in my career, I saw a lot of suffering around myself in India. And I think it is biological or maybe inherited from my family. Fortunately, I was not indifferent to the suffering that I saw around myself. And I used to see kids begging when I used to drive around with my son sitting next to me. And I always used to wonder how come my son is sitting next to me and is going to have most likely a good life. And there are these kids who don't even know where the food is going to come from. And at that early stage, it was clear to me that I wanted to do something for the underprivileged kids. And because education had done a lot for me, I feel that education is something that really empowers people. And I decided to get into education for underprivileged kids. And we started that about, I think, 12, 13 years back, a foundation. And my intent, Ari, was to, do something significant for the vulnerable kids. But about 5 or 6 years back, my niece forwarded some videos to me. They were PETA videos. And for the first time, I realized how milk is produced. I've always been a vegetarian, being part of the Indian system, and we had certain family practices. But milk is kind of an addiction in India. We love having milk and all kinds of byproducts. But when I saw how milk is produced, for the first time, the artificial insemination, the cruelty that cows go through who we call our mother because we get our milk from her. I was absolutely shocked. And then I got deeper into this topic. I spoke to a number of people, and it became clear to me that this is the cause I wanted to dedicate myself to. So, you know, this is how I got into animal welfare. And the other turning point, Ari, which I feel really blessed about is going for a Vipassana meditation retreat about 3 years back. And I must say that I regard that as the real starting point of my inner transformation. Before that, I was oblivious to who I have been and the fact that I need to change a lot inside myself. It was more external till then. And it's only after I did the Vipassana retreat and I started reading about Buddhism and I got deeper into it, I realized, oh my God, I need to change myself a lot. I had actually not even scratched the surface of trying to understand myself, my ego, my sense of self. And unless I address that, I can't really make any external change or even think of influencing anybody else. It's a very late start to my inner transformation journey, and it's very early stages, but I'm glad I'm on this path. Yeah. So a rather long answer to your question, Adi.
Well, I'm sure you could augment that a lot too. I'm curious, as we, you know, we can go through the time chronology of your life, but specifically about the connection between your animal work, which started, and then shortly after Vipassana. Do those feel like separate things or integrated whole for you? And when you came across Vipassana meditation, how did that inform your service work?
Actually, till I went for the Vipassana retreat, Ari, while they, I think, superficially appeared to be integrated to me, I think in reality they were not. And one thing that Vipassana has done for me is to make me better appreciate the reason why all this suffering and cruelty exists in the world. You know, one of my struggles after my door of awareness was opened to animal cruelty has been, how can man be so cruel, you know, to his fellow beings, both human beings and non-humans? And I think with Vipassana, I am slowly beginning to understand that the root of all this is ignorance. And I think once we get rid of our ignorance, that is how we come out of this, all the fears and anxieties that sit inside us. And all the cruelty that we see in the world is nothing but a manifestation of our own fears and anxieties. And this is helping me understand this a lot better and not react to things and become more measured and compassionate towards others. So I must say that now it feels a lot more integrated, and I really wish that others would go through the same experience that I'm going through, because it is so positive. I'm not yet fully there, I must admit. There are still moments of distress and disappointment with what I see around me. But practicing meditation and reading about it really helps, really helps. And I believe, I hope to make, you know, better impact as I remain on this path.
One of the things I've seen with animal advocates, and I, in my own personal experience, is that once you, there's a opening your eyes to something that you can no longer unsee after you see it. Like there's just an awareness. It's kind of like they talk about as insight in Vipassana practice, which is really often translated as insight meditation. I wonder what you've noticed about yourself, why you're able to have that insight around dairy animals, dairy cows, and why you couldn't see it before. And what do you think prevents, in all your work for animal advocacy, what do you think prevents other people from having the insight of being able to perceive the cruelty that exists within our food system? And then how are you taking that perception and helping to open people's eyes so they can be less caught in fear and anxiety and indifference.
That's a great question, Ari. I've often wondered as to, in my experience, I think there are people who, I think a vast majority, a very large majority, probably 99% of this world, or maybe 95% of this world, isn't aware of the cruelty that's perpetrated. And if somehow they were to become aware, I do think a good proportion of them will change. They will change their behavior. Having said that, I think there are people who will take longer to come out of ignorance, because we are a prisoner of, all of us are a prisoner of our senses, you know, sense pleasures, the habits, the conditioning, what we have grown up with. So there are people who have grown up thinking animals are there to eat. There's a food chain, and it's absolutely fine to eat animals, and they are a commodity. So I think some people become aware of this and are able to change instantly. They get this insight. Some will take a little longer, and some will take several lifetimes probably to change. And you know, I'm reminded of that whenever I try to influence someone and they don't still see the reality. I remember this beautiful story about Buddha when he got enlightened. He said that there are three types of, you know, there is a lotus that sits at the bottom of the pond, and then there is a lotus that comes to the surface and just simply touches the water, and then there are those that rise above the water. So there are these three types of people who will always be there. And he overcome the initial doubts and said, I must teach the world whatever I have learned. And there are people who will benefit from it, and there are people who will not still see it, but that's fine. So I think that is the attitude animal advocates should take. And you know what I'm doing, I think the second part of your questionnaire, I do feel that raising awareness is a massive task, and probably the most important task. And I think we need to find a way to integrate compassion towards animals and the changes that which are needed in the food system into our education system. That's one thing which is crucial, and we have just started some work on that. So we are now creating a strategy to integrate that into the school and the colleges and the curriculum in India. It's going to take several years, but we've just started some very important work on this. And the second thing I believe is influence the influencers is very crucial. So there are people who influence the society, who take decisions to allocate capital, who take decisions to inform the public about things, whether they are in the media, in the corporate world, academicians, and so on. So I believe that we need to influence the influencers. And again, some will see the reality and some will not, but that's fine. So that's the path I'm trying to take.
Things you said, Parag, here is that it's about your journey, is that it's so positive, the most recent journey. I'm curious about the pain that's come with the journey as well. There's when you open your eyes and you could see things you couldn't see before, and
Yes.
the pain become more obvious. You wouldn't whether there's the dogs in the street that you fed you share that you feed every morning. You care about the kids that were that you helped in your community who didn't have the same benefits as your children have, and trying to support them. And then of course all the animals behind closed doors that you'd see people butting to things, but you knew what the suffering was behind that. How has it been like for you to can you to hold that? Is it overwhelming? How much do you keep awareness of that, and how much is it not helpful to remain aware of the cruelty and the suffering and the indifference that goes on, that's so pervasive and is antithetical to the work you're trying to do in the world, especially from people you probably respect in so many other ways?
Yes, that's a difficult one, Ari. I must say that you know, I have after I completed my Vipassana retreat, one of the natural reactions was to actually not become active on social media. And I'm not active on social media. I think it's a distraction. There are positives, of course, but it's by and large for me, it's a distraction. And the suffering that one sees does impact me, I must say. But what helps is I also read Bhagavad Gita, Ari, and you know the summary of Bhagavad Gita is actually very similar to what Buddhism teaches, which is equanimity. So you must do your job without getting attached to the fruits of what you're doing, the fruits of your action. And I remind myself of that repeatedly. I must say that I try to stay away from cruelty. And whenever I see it, I have to meditate and bring myself back to the core, to these teachings, to overcome that. So it does bring pain. And there's also another kind of pain, Ari, which I must admit to, which is as I started going deeper inside myself and I realized how centered in myself I am, the I and the me. And I also then realized that over the years, I have also unintentionally done things, or there have been acts of omission for sure, that have led to suffering for others. And I have come face to face with that, you know, as a result of Vipassana. And it's a very liberating feeling. It is initially distressing, but it's also very liberating. So that's also that suffering or pain that you go through when you go inside yourself. So that's another dimension of it.
What I'm hearing you say is that it helps you be less judgmental of others' contributions to suffering, recognizing that there's a mirror of your own omissions where you've helped contribute to suffering or do continually without your own awareness. Is that right?
Yes, that's very beautifully said. Yes, Ari. And you know, just to build on that, one of the things I've realized is every time you see a fault in someone else, if you think deeply about it, you realize that that fault exists in you as well. Maybe to a different degree, maybe it is more or less. So I may think that I'm free of greed, and I might judge somebody else as being greedy. But when I look at my own behavior very carefully, I will find instances of greed or traces of greed in myself, thoughts of greed from time to time. So every fault that we see in others exists in us has been a learning for me.
Yeah, that's sounds like a meaningful practice to cultivate humility as you work, you know, at very often major levers of change, influencers and otherwise, to keep grounded.
Yes.
I'm curious about your comment about, you know, equanimity and the Bhagavad Gita, not being attached. Something I've sometimes struggled with in that aspiration is the realization that, yes, important to be equanimous, not be attached to outcomes, but outcomes are very insightful for what's working, what's not working. And so there's a difference between not getting caught in outcomes and being indifferent to outcomes.
Yes.
Could you, is that been an inquiry for you at all in your work about how to, and how to, you know, how to walk that line?
Another fantastic question, Ari, and I'm so glad I'm talking to you. I've also thought about this, and I faced this, and I continue to face this. And one of the books that, you know, on these interpretation of Gita, the introduction that he has written to it is so beautiful. In a few pages, he just captures the essence. And I go back to it again and again. He says that being detached from the outcomes does not mean indifference to outcomes. You are still focused on what is working, what is not working. But being detached from the outcome, one is able to, in an unattached manner, think through very carefully, calmly, what needs to be done in the current situation and take the right actions. And it appears to me that Gandhiji, actually lived this, Ari. And I think so long as the actions we are taking are truly selfless, it is possible to do it. I think if what we are working on is not selfless, there is some trace of selfishness in that. So if I'm doing charity, but I'm doing charity in order to make a name for myself, and there is this trace of self in that charity, that is not selfless, and then I will remain attached to the outcome. So it appears to me that the answer to this lies in being truly selfless in whatever you are doing. And if that's what you're doing, then the outcomes, it is possible to detach from outcomes while without being indifferent to outcomes. Now, I'm not there yet, I must fully admit. But that seems to be the answer to me, Ari.
Well, on that note, you've had some pretty remarkable outcomes in a very short amount of time working on this. It's been my labor of love and my dharma to take animals out of the food system. And, I've been at this for about a couple decades. In a very short amount of time, you founded, what is it, four groups I counted in that introduction in India. And they're already having a really big impact. So there's something that you're doing that has a very, as I said, is taking intentions into manifestation in a very short amount of time. Is there something like for people listening who have a lot that they care about and are trying to address in various forms of cruelty, injustice, suffering, economic disparities or climate issues or other environmental issues that you have that you've learned that makes it easier for you, that you've seen that it helps go from concept or from heart to concept to model to fruition? I'm wondering if you can maybe what you've learned along the path, because you seem to have something some knowledge there.
Yeah. So Ari, I feel that first of all, whatever little we have accomplished so far, and it still needs to scale up, but it's a good start, is by learning from others. That's the first thing I must tell you. When a few years back I decided to get into this area, I got in touch with people like you. I got in touch with you, with David Meyer, with Satish, and I learned so much about how so much more mature the movement is in the US. And gradually it became clear to me, I guess it's because of my corporate thinking, my corporate life, where we are trained to think big. We are trained to think of how to scale things up and how to go to the root cause. That pretty soon I realized, Ari, that to make an impact, you have to work on an ecosystem. Because to solve any complex problem, you need to work on the ecosystem. And I think it applies to any cause or any problem that you're working on. You can be at the two ends of a spectrum. The one is the immediate. So we can do rescue and relief for an animal who's injured and is bleeding on the street. And that's important too. And you can do something for the animals that are not even born. And you hope they will never be born if you succeed. So it's the two ends of the spectrum. And as you start going deeper into any cause, you realize that you need to make systemic changes if you want to tackle the problem in a holistic manner. And, I think there are four pillars that are crucial for this problem. One is awareness that we discussed. And awareness needs to be raised with multiple stakeholders. And one has to be also clear about the stakeholders involved. The second, I think, is talent. We need talent to solve any problem. And that's one of the problems that we face in India, which is also in some way linked to capital. But we need more talent, we need more leaders. And therefore, one of the first things that we did was to start a fellowship program inspired by Teach for India, which itself is modeled on Teach for America, which has been hugely successful in India, Gandhi Fellowship and Teach for India. So the second thing to solve is talent. The third thing to solve is policy, both private and public. And fourth, of course, is capital. How do we attract more philanthropists? How do we attract more funders to engage with animal welfare? Because it's not just about the animals. It's about all of us. It's the entire planet and the humanity. There are so many intersections with climate, with public health, with mental health, and so on. So these, I, you know, just to summarize, you know, it has to be an ecosystem change. And these are the four broad pillars that I see, which I think one has to work on.
Well, that's very thoughtful. And that how you're working on, I know personally you're working on each of those. It sounds like there's a lot you've gained from your corporate experience to apply. There's a very methodical way to go about solving problems you've learned in the corporate world. Are there things you're needing to unlearn as well as you go through this that the corporate world has actually taken you away from that maybe are useful in that milieu but aren't really useful in the area of service or in the area of societal transformation of the heart?
Yes, there are. Actually, there are. I think I spoke about the positives, which is scalability, technology, how to leverage technology, and so on. I think the things that I am unlearning, one is this whole, the system of capitalism, Ari, and this single-minded obsession with growth. I don't think it's working, but unfortunately, that's how the society is constructed today. So the countries are chasing GDP growth, companies are chasing sales and profit growth, and people are chasing growth in bank balance and their assets and so on. So this whole mindset about growth and the KPIs that we have in capitalism, I think is not working. And it leads to inequitable distribution of wealth. And I think one of the key solutions, if we are to survive as a planet and thrive, is to actually minimize consumption. But nobody talks about it. It's all about growth. How can you grow the GDP? Even I find that a lot of very profound thinkers who talk about solving the world problems of the world are not really touching on this aspect because it's and poor, the poor obviously want more to have a better life, but the rich also want to consume more. So that's one thing that I think I'm beginning to realize. For most part of my life, I was an unabashed admirer of capitalism. But in the last few years, I've realized that there are certain things which are not working. And I think ESG, I hope it really succeeds and scales up. It's an experiment right now. The second thing I must say, which I need to unlearn, is authenticity. I think what happens in a corporate environment, and that's how the system is built, is because it's very results focused. You define a goal, and it's okay to use any means to get to that goal. Of course, it's not the same in every company. You know, there are companies that are driven by values and so on. But by and large, it is acceptable to chase a goal and adopt any means to get to that goal. And even if that means being less than authentic, not being your true self. That's the world, that's a system that has got created. And I think that does not work when you are trying to do good. In fact, you have to be 100% authentic to yourself first, and then to others, and then only you can create change. Yeah, so these are the two things that come to my mind, Harry.
Thank you, Parag. There's a question in the chat, and it's alive for me as well. Is you help wear many hats. You're a father. You are CFO of a large company. You run a foundation, you've got nonprofits, you work for the more, you feed animals in the area, dogs. How do you integrate all those many lives? Does it feel heavy at times? What does balance look like amongst the different roles you wear? And how do you choose where to spend your time each moment, given there's probably no limit to how much time you spend on each of those roles?
Yeah, that's very true, Ari. And I think there are two things I must say. One is, of course, I must say it feels heavy at times. But before that, one of the things that has helped me is post my Vipassana meditation retreat about 3 years back, it became clear to me that one of the things that I need to really try is to purify myself and slowly, hopefully, get rid of all the impurities like irritation and anger and greed and whatever. And as you start coming face to face with these impurities, and you start getting rid of them, it actually releases energy. Because there is a lot of mental energy that goes away in this. For example, if there is a development on the political front in the country, and I read that in the news, and I don't agree with it, and I get perturbed about that development, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to discuss that with some of my family members and friends. They might have a different view, and it leads to a debate, and so on. But at the end of it, there is nothing positive I can contribute to that issue. So what I've done is I've actually stopped reading news. For the last 2.5 years, I've not read any news. I just get to hear this from people I know. And that saves a lot of energy, huge amount of energy and time it releases for me. And I therefore focus on just two things, my day job, and the second is whatever I can do to help the animals. The area where I think I'm spending relatively less time and my family would conquer is spending time with my family. And that's what I'm hoping to do once I, retire from my full-time executive life. Yeah. But it feels heavy at times, I must say.
Right. When it does feel heavy, is it, there's a saying that if you feel stressed, if you don't have enough time to meditate, if you should meditate, let's say an hour a day, but if you don't have time to meditate, you should meditate 2 hours a day. I used to hear people say that. I don't subscribe to that anymore, but when it does feel heavy, like what's that like? And how do you work with the heaviness? Because it's such a there's so much suffering that you're trying to address, and sometimes it feels like it's more important to address that suffering than address the heaviness that you feel. Curious how like you manage that and weigh the outer world versus the inner world in prioritization.
The tactic that I use, Ari, is to just go back to read Buddhism and Gandhiji, his translation of the Bhagavad Gita. It gives me tremendous peace. So when it feels heavy and when it feels unmanageable, every night actually I read on these two topics, depending on the mood that evening, I'll pick up one of the books and read it for, at least 20 to 30 minutes. And if time permits, do a bit of meditation. And that makes me really peaceful. So that's what seems to work for me, Ari. Yes.
One of the things that spoke to me of what you were sharing is just your ability to focus on where you feel you have agency in your life instead of all the problems in the world. Like, if you can't do anything about it, then you either don't engage or just have to accept. I
Yes.
remember, watching what's happened in Israel and Gaza. It actually made me a lot more grateful for working with animals because it And that's a problem in Israel and Gaza that's been going on for centuries. Definitely since I was born, since the founding of Israel, and it's never and so much attention is put towards that, and it's like always felt like, oh, like I feel grief about this, but I don't have feel like I can do anything about it. And it made me feel that much better about working in Amazon because they're like, oh, this is something that's actually doable. It's in my control. Like there's something I can do locally. There's something I can do nationally. There's something I can do globally. There's conversations to have. It seems it seems much more tractable. And so I think that's wise advice that you shared for anyone listening who gets caught up in issues beyond their influence. There's a question in the chat that asks, what advice you'd give to a 25-year-old fresh in corporate life who might be very driven towards achievement?
What advice? Okay, I was also there myself. So, right. So, what advice would I give? I think first I would say find 10 days in your life and go for a Vipassana retreat. It'll do you a lot of good, believe me. And, don't think that it's an invitation to become a monk. It is not. It will lead to a far better, more balanced life. You can integrate things a lot better. So you can be actually even more successful in the corporate world if you follow meditation. So that's one advice I would give. And the second advice I would give to a 25-year-old youngster would be to set aside some percentage of your earnings to give. It can be as small as 1%. You start with 1% of your monthly earnings. And you can, as you feel more secure, more confident, as your life progresses, you can increase that percentage, you can keep it same, but do start with giving pretty early. It is very joyful.
Was it when you started giving half your income or half your wealth, or started moving towards that? Was that hard for you? Were you giving a lot before then? Was that a dramatic shift? And when you do give, what does that feel like? Is it hard to like let go of something you've been holding on to and worked very hard to create? I'd be curious for your own experience and not like and what learnings there are as you try to encourage people to be more generous and to live more open-handed.
So, as I said earlier, I think there is something biological, at least in my case. I think it came naturally to me. And as I started earning, I started giving. But yes, and it increased progressively. But when it came to taking a giving pledge, actually, it wasn't very hard. It was clear to me that we have more than what we need. And I think, it's very important to distinguish between needs and desires. You can never fulfill all your desires. So if one is going to focus on desires, then you can have all the wealth in the world. It's not enough. But it was very clear that I had been lucky in my career, and we had more than what we needed. So it seemed natural, and sharing 50% seems very logical. You have something, you take half and you give half. So that's very logical. So I've not found it hard to give, Ari. And I think, again, I keep coming back to Buddhism and Vipassana. I think as one is on this path, one can see the reality and one can see how transient everything is. And the attachment to all the physical objects. And money is fiction, actually, to be honest with you. I actually feel that one of the worst inventions of the modern world is the virtual money because it allows us to hold. In a barter system, you can hold a little bit, but not a lot. And this system now allows us to hold, which is creating challenges in the world. So I think, yeah, gradually you start becoming detached. So honestly, in my case, I've not found it hard to let go. Yeah.
Thank you for that. One thing, just a little change of subject here, but related to generosity, a different form of generosity, is that, my wife's a doctor, and there's a fulfillment she gets from helping the sick patients. When I've been, there's a film where you're talking about helping the street dogs. I've been to India multiple times, and there's, a lot of friends in service space or do work to help people living without homes or living in the shanty towns there. And there's a sort of relationship between giver and receiver that's really fulfilling. And you can see the benefit that's being created. So often working with animal farm animals, you're benefiting, as you said before, you're benefiting someone who will never be born, to not be born in suffering. How does that feel different, that kind of service? When it's hard to have an intimacy and direct relationship with those who you're trying to be of service to. And you think that's kind of a problem or a challenge for why not many people have done work and who care about the suffering of these farm animals because there's such a distance they have from them.
Right. No, that's again another great question, Ari. I think there is this instant gratification that human beings want. And even when we are helping someone, we want to see the impact of that immediately. And that's the reason, giving food to somebody on the street or helping someone on the street versus helping someone in Africa who's suffering a lot more, people tend to go for the former. So I think there is some truth in that, Ari. And I guess it's a journey. I think when you engage in giving, in trying to alleviate suffering of others, I think serving with your own hands and with your own time is also hugely important. And I must admit that that's something I miss. I would like to do that. So once I get more time on my hands, I do plan to spend more time in an animal shelter or maybe even helping the poor kids, with my own hands. And, so it's a bit like in the corporate sector, we say that you must be close to the consumer. Similarly, I would like to be close to the animals and help them with my own hands while doing things for the animals who are not yet born. But I think it's a journey. So it's like you graduate from one step to another. That's what I think.
And in that longing to have be more intimate with those you are affecting and being of service to them, what is your relationship to doing the most good as you can? The systemic work, the work that helps maybe millions versus the one animal you feed. How do you balance, there's a movement that I know you're familiar with called effective altruism, which is trying to do the most good you can do. In some ways, it's not very service-based like in terms of it is, but it isn't because it's there's a because it's less in some ways it can be less embodied, it can be a little more theoretical in some ways. I'm wondering, what's your take on effective altruism? Is that something that you want to be as effective in reducing as much suffering as possible? And how does that integrate with your, feeding dogs versus working on influencing influencers to change people's diets that could affect hundreds of millions of people and therefore tens of millions of animals who live a life of great depravity.
I am on the side of making systemic long-term impact, even if you don't see the results in your lifetime. But I think having a small component of immediate relief is also important, just to stay grounded and see the reality. And it just feels good. When I go to out to feed dogs in the morning, it's a great start to the day, honestly. So serving somebody who needs something with your own time and hands just makes you stay grounded and makes you feel more. Makes you make fills you with even more compassion. So it's important from that point of view. But I think from the point of view of alleviating suffering, I firmly believe in effective altruism and making systemic change, irrespective of how long it might take to see the impact, see the results. So I have this broad rule of broadly, I allocate my personal philanthropic capital, 85% for long-term change and just 15% for short-term.
I like that as the guideposts. It's interesting. The work that I think we do, it's very deliberate and intentional. And it has and it requires that because it's not so obviously around us, the animal the beings that suffer. It's a lot like climate change in that way as well. What is it but what that takes away is that spontaneity of kindness, the spontaneity of like responsiveness to what's right in front of you. Have you noticed that at all? Like that sort of like sort of that like having a sort of a goal and a focus on that, that sometimes you miss the suffering right there. And what is that, that driving towards helping as many and systemic change? What is that like? And I heard you say doing the direct relief type work is really important to you, but more not as a 15%, 85% way, but just in a way that like there it is, it's right in front of me. Like, is it, do you still have the fine that ability to pause when you see it and let go of what you are working towards when there's pain right there. Curious about that experience for you.
Okay, yet another thoughtful question from you, Hari. So it's very true, actually. It is hard to do that. And I do face that often, I mean, when I'm driving around, I will see an animal who needs food, but I'm rushing for a meeting. And I don't have time to stop and help the animal. And, but that meeting, maybe that meeting is for India Animal Fund to talk to a prospective donor. I don't know. I'm just making it up right now. So which is more important? Do you actually give up on that meeting and help that animal who needs help then and there? Yeah, it's not an easy one, Ari. I struggle with that, but and there was a time when I used to feel distressed about this. But gradually I have learned to manage that and not force things, I think. And that is where I feel that ultimate aim is to reach towards equanimity, and the answers come automatically. Answers will flow. So I've now got this belief that once we purify ourselves and we reach a stage of equanimity where then you are in a space where you have compassion for everyone. And the answers will come automatically. So you don't have to look for answers. So that this is my current take on it, but I hope I'll have a better answer in the years to come.
Slight change of direction, Parag, is for me, and I'm just wondering how you relate to this, is that I have felt a lot of pain over the years, having practiced Theravada Buddhism for a number of years, and learned about the practice of metta, of loving kindness, the precepts, non-killing in any way, non-stealing, and to see how antithetical it is the way we treat animals, and they're and by default by eating animals and animal products, how that doesn't those are out of alignment with some of those virtues. And seeing Buddhist teachers who preach one thing and seemingly like don't acknowledge that this is worthy of a cause, this is worthy of these animals are worthy of compassion, or that this a diet change is somehow, or existing dietary approaches are inconsistent with Dharma. Have you felt any stress around that as well? And how has that affected the way you receive the teachings of Dharma? Do you see any limitations of Dharma for people who have been practicing for decades and teach about it, yet somehow are missing this? The morality seems how to be from one species to the same species, and not with all species that we share this planet with.
Yes, I know what you mean, and I've also thought about it. I do feel going deeper into Buddhism, Ari, that I think things get distorted over centuries. If you go to the original teachings of the Buddha, it is very clear. You do not take life, you do not kill. And it includes everything on earth. In fact, I would even say that your compassion extends to even inanimate objects. And there are moments I sometimes feel that. So I think this is a distortion that has developed over the centuries in Buddhism. And for convenience sake, I'll give you another example of a distortion in another religion, Hindu religion. By birth, I'm a Hindu, and there is this caste system that has got entrenched in India. I am very sure that centuries ago, when it was thought through, there was a certain practical reason why it was thought through of dividing work amongst people. But the intent was not that by birth you belong to a certain class. And it got distorted over the centuries and got entrenched and led to huge discrimination against people. That's another example. So I think this is a distortion of Buddhism. I'm very sure if Buddha were alive today, he would be a vegan. I'm very sure because, if you see the cruelty, it's very obvious that you try to produce milk at mass scale in farms, and what you subject cows to is terrible. That's how I see it. I think it's a distortion, Ari, and I think they are ignorant.
Well, I mean, I have one last question before I pass it on to our host, Bonnie Rose, if that's okay. And that what it that's what is your edge right now for your own personal growth, and how does that integrate with your service in the world?
Sorry, if you could repeat the first part, Ari.
What is your edge right now, that your area of growth that you're working towards, where you in your personal life and spiritual life, and how does that integrate with your service? And then I'll pass it on to Bonnie after that.
No, first of all, I must thank you, Ari, for so many thoughtful questions. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I think one thing which I've learned through Vipassana is to not have a goal. It's important not to cling to anything. Because the minute you cling to something, you want to achieve something, even if something is spiritual, it will bring suffering. But having said that, I think I would say that I really think in the rest of my life, whatever is left of it, I would like to purify myself of all the impurities. That's the only thing I would like to do. So, these feelings of even irritation, there's a traffic jam, and why should you feel even slightly irritated? Getting rid of that, getting rid of all kinds of anger, greed, passion, ego. Ego is the biggest one, I believe. That's right on top for me. So I think that's really what I would like to do, to get rid of my impurities. And I think if hopefully I succeed in that, it should automatically result in my having more energy to serve the animals.
Thank you,
Thank
Bonnie.
you.
That's stuff. Thank you. As soon as my microphone comes on, my dogs start barking. They must know that there's an animal lover or three or four or ten on the call. Anyway, thank you so much. That was wonderful. I so enjoyed your questions, Ari, and Parag. I just love everything you said. It was just so inspiring. So now I want to open up questions to the rest of the group, to anybody who's listening. If you want to submit questions via the feed, you can go to ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And I will do my best to moderate them and try and give as many people a chance as I possibly can. So I'm going to start with a question from the US. And I'm curious too. You've talked a bit about how your corporate life has influenced your work in helping animals and in all of the great nonprofit things that you do in the world. Has your work in the nonprofit sector influenced your corporate life?
Okay, that's a great question. In some ways, yes, Bonnie, not enough, I must admit. And I have, as I've gone deeper into my cause, and I've sometimes felt conflicted, actually, because it's like sometimes it feels like living in two very different worlds. And trying to take what I learn in the not-for-profit world into the corporate sector, I have tried to, for example, I'll give you a concrete example. The whole area of sustainability, or ESG, which is becoming a big, big topic today in the corporate world. My work in the not-for-profit world has made me far more interested in sustainability. And I spend more time engaging in that topic at work than I would have done otherwise. So that's one clear influence. The second is I have become far more vocal about doing something for the world at large at my workplace. So everybody knows that I'm an animal lover. Everyone in my company knows I am very open about it. And hopefully, it'll rub off on some people. So these are some of the changes that I've seen. But as I said, fundamentally, the corporate world is driven by a different set of KPIs. And we are at this point in time very far from making a fundamental change unless those KPIs change. And I think the sustainability and ESG is a very important experiment, and I hope it really scales up and succeeds.
Wow, wonderful. Thank you. So it sounds like there might be a slight conflict of values, but it's not enough at this point to keep you from doing one or the other, right?
Yes, that indeed is the case. In fact, I feel that anyone who's in this position must find a way to integrate the two. It's not easy, it's difficult, but one has to integrate the two, because being in the corporate world also opens up a lot of possibilities, one's network that one can leverage for the cause. So yes, there are a lot of upsides too.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've got a question from Alan, and I think you covered a bit of this, but he's asking about how that you have the ability to hold the awareness of the suffering in the world and also to show up and be of service with a positive attitude and with a smile on your face. And how do you do that? And what fills up your reservoir of joy that you can do that?
So I think one thing I covered to some extent earlier, Bonnie and Alan, which is I just go back to Bhagavad Gita, Gandhiji's interpretation of Bhagavad Gita and Buddhism, and that gives me a lot of peace. The other thing which I like to do, but I don't get time to do enough of, is being with the nature. That's another way, great way to heal myself. It heals me. But I don't get the time to do that enough. So, that's my refuge, actually.
Thank you. And this is a related question, but I know that a lot of people that are working for change in the world, that sometimes it seems like the problem is too big and they struggle with futility and the feeling that they're not making enough of a difference. Does that ever happen to you? And if so, how do you cope with that?
That's very true. I mean, I have thought about it many times. Helping the animals, the way they are used, or rather abused in the society in many ways, for entertainment, as companion animals, for food, for drug testing, and so on. Each of these is a very complex topic, and it has got entrenched over centuries. So the question is, am I working on a lost cause, or is there some impact I can make? And I think I've really thought about it. And ultimately, Bonnie, I feel that I don't believe that there is some authority or someone sitting there that's running the world. It's really our actions that produce its cause and effect. And Buddhism talks about cause and effect and the karma, the effect of the karma that we do. So at every second, there are trillions of actions which are happening in the world at any point in time. And that's what determines what happens next. And I do believe that all the work that people who have compassion, who are serving others are doing, will in some way go towards creating a more compassionate world. And my hope is that there will be more and more people with compassion who will keep doing what they're doing and will keep multiplying the impact. And maybe at some point in time, that inflection point will emerge. Also, what gives me hope is that I think the human consciousness is expanding. So if you know, 100 years back, there used to be slaves. I mean, today it feels shocking that you could have another human as a slave. Or gender equality, inequality was a huge problem. And today, it's well accepted, even in the corporate sector, that gender equality is so, so important and diversity is important. LGBTQ, you know, it was considered a mental disease. Even today, there is a challenge in many parts of the world, but our consciousness is expanding. And my sense is that it will continue to expand to include all sentient beings, all the animals. So I think it's a journey that humanity is going through. And therefore, people like us must keep working on this and contribute to that expansion of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to take sort of a sideline here because a couple of people have asked this question. You work for a pharmaceutical company and people are asking about animal testing. Does your company do that? And are you experimenting with ways to reduce animal testing in pharmaceutical development?
Yes, that's a very important question. And I've actually, sometimes I sit in meetings where we discuss briefly these tests, and I must say I feel uncomfortable. But having said that, I know that fortunately in this area, the interests of people who want animals not to be used as an object of testing and the pharma industry are aligned. So actually, pharma industry would also like to avoid animal testing because it makes the whole drug testing process more expensive and longer. Mm-hmm. And now alternative technologies are becoming available. So I'm indeed, in fact, more than a year back, I've discussed this with the leadership of my company. And in India, they are very aligned and happy to lead this agenda. And we are currently working on creating a core group and to do some research to understand which of the tests can be replaced by alternative technologies. There are many challenges. For example, in some cases, there is no alternative available. And therefore, some R&D and technological innovation is needed to replace that. In some cases, tests, alternatives are available, like organ on a chip or AI-based testing, but they are not available in India, or they are still very expensive because they are not scaled up yet. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a need to define this problem. In fact, I was planning to connect with my peer group in the US to go deeper into this topic. But this is an important topic, and I'm happy to say that my company is actually supporting this agenda.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, people get their idea in their head is this is the way it is. We test on animals that we eat meat or dairy or whatever. And what you said before about consciousness expanding and moving past the place where that's the go-to, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is this is what we do, and moving into greater possibilities. I heard a lot of that in what you just said, so thank you for that. So speaking of greater possibilities, Carrie from the US is asking, can you share a story about a colleague or another person in your life whose heart and perhaps behavior has been changed by hearing about your perspectives around animals deserving the same kind of compassion that humans deserve?
Right. So I think there are, I think, a few people. I will say the chairman of my company, he's a very compassionate person and believes a lot in sustainability. And I remember that when we launched India Animal Fund, he said, Parag, I wasn't aware of this concept of sentience. And I mean, he's the head of a large pharma company that tests drugs on animals. And he did say that, you know, I've now become aware of this concept. And so that was an example of, you know, the use of animals, which is normally taken for granted and is taken as normal, I think entered his circle of awareness. You know, like this, there are other instances. To be honest with you, I must tell you, Bonnie, that I refrain from trying to influence people on a one-on-one basis. I believe that change comes when people look inside themselves and when they're exposed to something that changes their beliefs. And therefore, there are a number of things that we are doing to raise awareness, but I do not try to force people to change their choices. So I abstain from doing that.
Yes. Well, yes, that brings me to another question, is that, you know, when you're coping with people's indifference, when you're confronted with people's indifference, and sometimes people just don't want to hear it because it's too painful to hear.
Yes.
How do you deal with that? Like, what do you do?
So I must admit that it leads to disappointment first. And for example, it's very common that I try to use my network to try to achieve a certain goal for the cause. You know, writing to a CEO, for example. In fact, just yesterday evening, I got an email from the CEO of a large company in India, whom I had written to about moving to cage-free eggs. But clearly, you know, there are other compulsions and it's not working. So that's one example. So that happens very often. It does lead to disappointment, but again, I go back to my teachings of Vipassana. And you know, the fact is that people are doing this not because they want to slight you or insult you. It's just because they are ignorant. They have not yet reached a state where they understand the suffering that their choices are, you know, making on animals or other fellow beings, in fact. And they are just too busy in their daily life, which is what I was honestly doing till a few years back. You know, I was doing the same. So it's because they are ignorant, and that's the truth. And once we, I think, understand that fundamental thing, then it helps. That's what helps me. Yeah.
Yeah, understanding ignorance. What do you think the source of ignorance is? Or is there an antidote to ignorance? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, whatever I'm saying is what I've learned from Buddhism, Bonnie. So I think the cure to ignorance is really awareness.
Awareness.
Awareness. I think, and meditation helps bring awareness. So being established in awareness and meditating, I believe the whole world should meditate. I actually advise all youngsters, all my colleagues at every available opportunity to meditate. And I think doing it for some time every day is important. It's not the duration, but the frequency of it, which is really important. So I think meditation leads to the mind calming down because today's world has too many distractions and our system forces us to do things to earn a livelihood in a certain way and to work for 12 hours a day or, you know, whatever. So I think becoming established in awareness and looking inside you is what leads to realizing that our brain, we are a prisoner of our mind, actually. We are just chasing pleasures all the time. The next fantastic meal or the next vacation or the next promotion, the next car, and so on. But we don't realize that this is not going to give us happiness. So it's an illusion. And I think meditation is the, in my view, is the way to get out of it.
Thank you. You know, you've talked not only in the answer to this question, but also in some of the interview about chasing, I would say, chasing desires. Do you think that there is a desire behind all desires? Like somebody might be chasing a great meal or a great car or a great possession and hoarding money so that they can have all that stuff. But what is it that you think people really want?
I think people want to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're chasing happiness. Mm-hmm. And they think that they can get happiness by through the next car, the next house, or the next meal or vacation. But when they get it, they realize, oh my, they don't realize, unfortunately, that it just gives you temporary relief. It does not give you happiness. And therefore, just becoming aware of the fact that we are chasing pleasures, and pleasure and pain are two sides of the same coin. You know, everything that gives pleasure, when it actually disappears, gives us pain and suffering. So just becoming aware of this, and understanding the root cause, which is our mind, and doing something about it is I think the solution. I think my battery is running low, so I just need to just give me a second.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, I'm back.
You got it? Okay, great. Thank you. So when you're discerning where to give, it sounds like giving and serving brings you great joy. When you discern like that you're going to give time to this organization or time to this cause or time to your family or this, what is your measure? What is your barometer? Like, how do you choose one organization or one project over another? What's your discernment factor with that?
Yeah, I think choosing one organization or a project over another, I think the biggest thing is the person behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the person is passionate and truly believes in the cause, then it's important to back that person. So I really think that most of the work that we do, it's all about finding passionate people and backing them and helping them, empowering them. And that's what my foundation, India Animal Fund, seeks to do. You know, our objective is to be a builder of the movement. I know it sounds very grand, but in a small way, that's what we are hoping to do. So it's about empowering people and empowering organizations who are passionate, building their capacity, funding them, creating strategies alongside them, and supporting them when they're going wrong and so on. So it's all about, I think, backing people, backing the right people.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm reminded of that. It's a quote from Howard Thurman about what makes you come alive. And it sounds like people, certain people, and their passion and their causes.
Yes, absolutely. I think that I think working for the cause makes me come alive. Being with the nature, Bonnie, makes me come alive. Talking to people like you and Ali makes me come alive. Yes.
I think you make a lot of people come alive as well. I'm so glad to be here. Okay, I've got another question. This one is from India. And this person asks, let me pull it up again. You mentioned that your purpose is to serve the vulnerable. Has your inner awareness journey helped you understand your own vulnerabilities and even embrace these vulnerabilities in a healthier manner?
Yes, the great question. Absolutely. I think I must say that I'm at an early stage of that journey, because I started meditating about 3 years back. And I think I mentioned to Ari earlier that I have indeed, actually, it has been a big surprise to me, the kind of weaknesses and impurities I have. I never realized it, you know. I had a self-image of someone who is successful and who is doing well in various roles and the various hats that I wear. Without realizing the anxieties and the fears that are deep down inside me, and mm-hmm. most importantly, the huge sense of self, mm-hmm. and clinging to beliefs and ideas, I believe that's the biggest problem that I have. So, to answer this question is yes, I do. I come face to face with some of my priorities, but not yet with all of them. And there are moments when it feels like it feels a bit distressing, but actually, ultimately, it is very liberating.
You know what?
Yes.
Your audio broke up for a bit of that, so I think maybe I know I
Okay.
missed it, and one of our colleagues missed it. Can you just repeat that again? Because it sounded
Yes,
really
yes.
good. I heard it was really good.
Now I can
Thank you.
repeat that. So I must say that I have come face to face with many of the impurities and vulnerabilities inside me. And I think one of the big ones is the sense of self and ego and my tendency to cling to my ideas and opinions, which I see becoming an issue very often at workplace also. And therefore, on this journey, as I come face to face with my ideas and many more
Well, I must not be meant to hear that because you kind of broke up again. But just a couple of things about that.
I think it's an important point. I wanted to say that coming face to face with your vulnerabilities is actually very liberating.
Yes. And it also sounds like you're able to do it in a way without attacking yourself for having vulnerabilities. You do it in a very compassionate way. Am I
Yeah,
correct?
I don't think I'm fully there yet, but yes, that is ultimately that's where I land. But after some struggle.
Thank you. Let me think if there's anything else I want to ask you. We just have, you know what, we've got just about a minute left. So let's see. One more thing. Well, actually, two more things. Are you ever tempted to react in anger when people are doing cruel things to others? And if so, how do you mitigate that?
Yeah, this happens to me, and I think it's the only way to mitigate that, Bonnie, I think, is to become aware of that. Is to become aware that there is anger rising in you, and you lost your temper, and you said something which you should not have, which you would not have if you had understood that the other side is ignorant. And once you become aware of that anger, and I found that of late my anger is slowly coming down. And when that happens, you can actually react in a much more mature way that can hopefully, reduce the suffering in some way. Because anger doesn't help at all. I mean,
Okay, got some of that. We're still having a few little tech difficulties. But one last question that I'd like to ask you, and that
Bonnie, I'm going to
is
switch
there,
off my camera. I'm
I'm
going to switch off
sorry?
my camera to improve
Oh,
the,
okay. That might work. That might help it a bit. I just have one more question. And that is, in this work that you do, is there anything that Service Space and this ecosystem can do to support you in all of the good that you're bringing to the world and your vision and your work in the world? Is there any way that we can support that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just taking this cause to more and more people and this message of love for all sentient beings, I think is what Service Space can do. And I'm sure as you help me take this cause to more and more people, there will be a few who will want to become part of it For sure. So yeah, I think that's what I look forward to from the service space team. And I'm grateful, to be honest, for this entire conversation. It has been such a blessing talking to Bonnie, you, and to you, Ari. And I thank Service Space and the Awakening team for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And just, I think everybody here has so appreciated your presence and your honesty, your humility, your generosity, all of that, and so much more. Your commitment to service and your commitment to Vipassana and to understanding ignorance in others. I know that I've learned a lot, and I trust that everybody else has as well. I'm going to go ahead and pass the word over to Ari for a few moments and see if he has some words of closing, and then we'll take it from there. Ari, back to you.
I'm just thinking of a quote from the Christian tradition of St. Francis, and he said, "Not to hurt our humble brethren is our first duty to them." But to stop there is not enough. We have a higher mission to be of service to them whenever they require it. And Parag, I am so grateful for your presence on the planet to live out that quote, that wisdom, and that heart. You have beyond this call inspired me to be more skillful in being a voice for the voiceless. And I'm grateful for all the seeds you plant and the seeds that are already turning to blossom and the blossoms that will soon turn to fruit.
Thank you, Ari. And I think it's back to me now. Yes, go ahead. Sorry. Did I jump in? Okay. All right. So it's back to me. And I will go ahead and close the call in the same way that we started it. So we'll close our eyes and let's take a moment of collective silence in attunement and gratitude to honor everything that was offered here today, as well as the invisible causes and conditions that brought us together and the volunteers who make this call possible. Let's take just a moment to do that. Thank you, everybody.